You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
Yes, we are indeed hearing from Justice Minister Andrew Little again on a range of topics. We started by talking about how much the government needs to make public when it comes to legal advice for decisions such as a national lockdown.
The Epidemic Response Committee will issue summonses to the Solicitor General, the Director General of Health, the Police Commissioner, after the committee's chair, Simon Bridges, said that there are concerns about the legal advice for our lockdown not being made public. Do you think that it's important for information such as this to be made public?
No, what's important is that when decisions are taken and decrees are promulgated, which is what has happened, is that the authority for it is clearly spelled out and what is required is clearly spelled out. All of that has happened in the health notice. The constitutional outrage that Simon Bridges is trying to effect is one where he's trying to place himself as not only a parliamentarian, but actually as a judge as well. If somebody's concerned about the powers that, for example, the police are exercising or that a medical officer of health are exercising, then the place to do that is to challenge that in court, and there have already been court challenges on this. Mm. And it's for judges to decide whether or not the law has been applied. The role of parliamentarians is as lawmakers. We make the law, but then we have an independent branch of government called the judiciary that then interprets the law and decides whether or not it has been complied with or properly adhered to. Simon Bridges is completely confusing his role and the role of that committee. And look, there's never been a situation where the Crown has divulged the legal advice on which ministers have acted. And largely because if there is a legal challenge, like any other party to court, you know, you're entitled to maintain the confidentiality of your legal advice. I mean, he ought to know that because he's a former lawyer and Crown prosecutor. So this is a stunt on his part. It's a game playing. It's unfortunate that he's allowed things to descend to that sort of level, but you know, he's looking for every headline that he can get.
The Otago University law professor, Andrew Geddes, sort of echoed your concerns, saying that the concern for him centres around precedent in terms of accessibility of Parliament to government's legal advice. I sort of understand this in terms, you know, of our political system being one that upholds the separation of powers. What do you make of this and of his concerns?
Yeah, it is. I mean, the parliamentary committee has been set up, it was dominated by the opposition for a very good purpose, is that they're to scrutinise what happens and ask questions and some questions that, you know, are difficult that the government might not want to have asked. But that's what a proper accountability looks like. But that is the role of Parliament, to provide that scrutiny. But it's not the role of Parliament to get in behind the legal advice that Solicitor General provides to any Minister of the Crown, because you know, the Crown has to take action. And if there is a legal challenge, the Crown is entitled to resort to the legal advice that it has got. And that is the basis on which the Crown will defend itself in any legal action. But you don't disclose that in advance. And, you know, the legal system has always recognised the notion of legal privilege, that is to say that the advice that you get when you're taking action that has consequences for others is privileged to you, that is to say it is confidential to you. So this is an attempt to erode that principle. It should be looked at with considerable concern.
Obviously you are upholding the fact that there does need to be scrutiny because it is important for governments to be held accountable. Do you think that scrutiny should come down more to the advice given by public health experts about the necessity of preemptive shutdowns?
Yeah, we looked around the rest of the world and saw what was happening, saw those who had not responded in a very kind of effective way, had not taken the sort of measures that we were being advised to take, and that was the advice to us was very clear, that the health advice was very clear, which is we don't know the characteristics of this virus. It looks very contagious. It's a new virus, so it actually, you don't really know for some months until you know the true characteristics of it. But it's contagious, it's moving rapidly, it was in a lot of countries by the time we started taking action. It's in pretty much every country now. And we were told this is what we can predict, and therefore to avoid this, to avoid mass casualties, including fatalities, these are the measures that you have to take. And so we did that. Now, we did that. That was the health advice. We got legal advice as well. we've indicated that our decisions are based on our rights or the rights of the Crown under the Health Act, as well as the Civil Defence and Emergency Management Act. And for parliamentarians who are offering scrutiny, that's what they need to know. What was the statutory power that you claimed to use? Does it meet that? But it is not the right of parliament to say, and now we want your legal advice that we'll expose to all the world, because the Crown has to be able to defend itself.
Okay. Now, discussing the way that this highly contagious virus affected other countries, we, once safe to do so, have an idea of a trans-Tasman bubble. Now, I've seen some response to this idea as people not wanting to share travel and the risk of transmission with Australia. So what about this idea makes it a priority for the government?
I think, well, Australia and New Zealand are two countries that have followed a very similar path. I mean, I think Australia is still suffering a greater number of casualties and probably a slightly higher proportion. But in terms of responses, certainly at the state level, they've been very similar to what New Zealand has done. So the incident has been very small, and I think there is a sense that both countries are saying, you know, if we get to the point where we are confident that the virus is well under control and the risk is very minimal, then at that point we could look at opening up our borders. Now, it won't be wholesale, because I think even Australia is saying, look, the only safe place at the moment would be Tasmania, because there's still problems in New South Wales and Victoria. So I think while there was a desire to do so, the utmost precaution will be taken, because neither country, in fact no country, wants to make things worse, but neither of New Zealand or Australia, who've kind of managed this reasonably well, want to risk further outbreaks and having to, you know, potentially move back up alert levels and so on.
Of course. Now, moving to our final two topics, I noticed that the Human Rights Commission has received such an elevation of complaints related to the COVID-19 pandemic, which means this has been the most serious human rights emergency Aotearoa has experienced since 1945. And they say that discrimination against those who are Chinese in our community has heightened far and away more than anything else. I know that you and I have discussed before the fact that pandemics highlight pre-existing inequities, and I wondered if you agree that protecting groups from harassment such as this should be a measure of healthcare that is more robust all of the time and increasingly available in times such as this.
Yeah, definitely. And that is really disappointing to see, and good on the Human Rights Commission for calling that out, because they are, you know, they get a lot of complaints. But we also know that for every complaint they get, there'll be probably, you know, half a dozen to a dozen more where people just, you know, they feel so disempowered. They don't know what to do. They won't do anything about it. And we've seen in other countries too a similar thing, that it's become that the COVID-19 thing has become a reason to take out people's prejudices and racism against other communities, and particularly Asian communities, and especially the Chinese community. Mm. And there's, you know, we need to call that out wherever we can. I think I know that the police, in terms of their responses to things, they've indicated to me that they've had situations where they've observed racist comments being made to members of the Chinese community, and that's just totally unacceptable. This is not, you know, members of the Chinese community here are not responsible for this, you know, worldwide health pandemic, and you know, people should not be seeking to blame. This is something we've all got to deal with. There is always a risk of pandemic in the modern world, and that's life, and we deal with it, and this is the way we're dealing with it, but we don't go around being racist and prejudiced about it.
Now, the fact that we've reached level 3, I feel it is in some ways easier to envision some of the changes that a lot of us have been arguing were necessary throughout the time of Rahui. For myself, this has kind of meant thinking more about how we might approach the cannabis referendum in particular this year. And I know that you've said that the public should feel like they can meaningfully participate in the referendum as well as the other ones that we're having this year. So I'd like to just have a quick conversation about the engagement with referendums being important and the impact that complacency around them has on polarising referendums such as ones this year.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the two referendum questions we've got are two quite significant questions, the one about end-of-life choice and the other about legalising marijuana. So these are big steps to take in terms of social policy. And we should all be thinking very carefully about it. People do have the right to have a vote and elect the government, but they also have a right to have a say on these things. And these, although the end-of-life choice in particular has been thoroughly debated in Parliament, nevertheless, it's down to the electorate now to decide whether we want our country to take this step. Other countries have done it. And people have to weigh up. Is this, does this empower people? Does it give people a greater sense of dignity that once they're in a position where they're terminally ill, they've lost a lot of bodily function, they have lost their dignity in the sense of who they are, even though they're of sound mind, should they be able to make a decision to bring forward the time of their death. People bring religious values to that and various other views, but we need to have a good public debate about it. On cannabis, the argument there is this is a substance that's been absolutely prohibited for 50-odd years. It is around. It is around in significant numbers. The current arrangements are having negative health effects. Young people are getting access to it when desirably they shouldn't be. We don't have any real education about it, about its impact on people and how to use it sensibly. And here's an opportunity to change the settings we have around cannabis so that it can be a substance, even though it can cause harm, that can be used safely in the community. So we should make inquiries, find out. There will be all sorts of voices. Some of them will be, in my view, irrational. They'll be moralistic. Others will be looking at the science and the medicine of it. And we should listen to that and make up a judgment. Is there a better way to manage this substance that we know right now at the time of absolute prohibition is causing harm? Can we minimise that harm by doing things differently?
Yeah. It's really exciting that we have that opportunity to see what positive drug education could look like, hey?
Yeah, and that's the thing, I think. It's an opportunity, if we can strip it of its criminal stigma, to then actually have a real good education about it, educate young people, say, look, here's this thing. Actually, if you really want to experiment with it, the time is a little bit later in your life. Actually, you're in your 20s. It'll be safer for you because the risks are too great when you're younger. So it's not about saying don't, but it's about saying here's a safe way to consume this. And look, there's a bunch of factors that you might have, that some of which might say if you've got these factors, then actually you probably shouldn't be looking at this. Giving people the information and empowering them to make good decisions about their own health. That's really what we want.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.